This is KHOI 89.1 Story City Ames.
Welcome to Local Talk about the people, the events, and the stories of Central Iowa. I'm your host today, Ursula Rudenberg, and my co-host is...
Benjamin Beloit. How are you?
Today we're going to look again at Ames. Two different stories that we're going to look at. First, we're going to repeat an interview that we aired on the very first Local Talk about the exhibit, which is at the Octagon, about trains and how trains have influenced the history of our area. The exhibit at the Octagon is in its final weeks. It will end on October 28th, and on October 27th, they'll have their final gallery talk, Mail on Rails. The interview is with Kathy Svek, who is the co-president of the Ames Historical Society. And then in the second part of the show, we're going to talk about the Ames City budget. The process for forming the budget is just in the beginning stages. Last September, when we started Local Talk, during our first show, we discussed the origins of Ames. Don Wirth, my co-host at the time, described how the area where KHOI is located is actually the area where the city of Ames began, and how the railroad played a central role in the origins of this community.
The original plat of Ames ran from Duff Avenue to Burnett, and then from the railroad tracks up to 7th Street. And so we're practically right in the direct center of that, of where that all occurred.
A little bit about Cynthia Duff.
Cynthia Duff and her husband were residents of the area. We can't say they were residents of Ames because they were here before Ames was. They owned about a 320-acre farm up where the Meeker School is now, up around 20th and Duff in that area of town. The residents of what was the original plot of Ames weren't real hot on the railroads coming through their part of the state and were objecting to it. So John Blair, who was the president and creator of the railroad station, the Cedar Rapids and Missouri River Railroad, that was the original railroad came through town, contacted Cynthia, and she acted as his agent, buying the land from the original landowners and then turning around and selling it to Blair and the railroad. That was, as you can imagine, was met with mixed reactions. Some people were happy, some people weren't so happy. But the railroad came through, and as such, the town sprang up around here, as we said in earlier, the original plat between Duff and Burnett and the railroad tracks and 7th Street. And we at the Pantorium are about a block from Duff Avenue, a block from the railroad tracks and where the original train station was, and about half a block from where Cynthia Duff ran a restaurant. The location of that is now the Cynthia O. Duff Plaza, the walkway between Main Street and the parking lot south of Main Street. Cynthia was important to the creation of Ames, and we hope that our location here is symptomatic that we're going to be important to the development and spreading and sharing of the community of Ames and Story County in the area. We were were fortunate to contact Kathy Sveck and the Ames Historical Society about a exhibit that they have, and Ursula conducted an interview with Kathy, and that's what we're going to have. A little more about that, Ursula?
The exhibit at the Octagon really demonstrates that Ames was originated because of the railroad. So this exhibit is very interesting. It's about really the essence of how our town started. And Kathy Sveck came over to our building the other day and told us a little bit about the exhibit. This is Ursula Rudenberg with KHOI, and I'm here with Kathy Sveck, who is the president of the Historical Society.
Co-president.
Co-president.
Okay.
Who's the other president?
Mary Atherley. Sharing the team. We're a great team effort.
Awesome. Well, thank you for coming over and telling us about the railroad exhibit.
Well, the title of the show is Rail Reality, How the Trains Made Ames, and it will be up through the 28th of October.
And where is it?
It is at the Octagon, 427 Douglas. The historical exhibit is on third floor. There are two galleries on the third floor, and the main gallery has the more historical slant. We looked at six very critical time periods when the trains were very key in what was going on in Ames, and we took an in-depth look at that. And the display panels are full of wonderful pictures and wonderful stories. It does take a little time to get through it, so we hope that if you run out of time that you will come back. The other gallery on third floor has model trains. Woohoo! And one of them is a model of what the rail yard used to look like when it was directly behind Main Street. So we had good information about what the rail yard looked like about the mid-1930s. So it is a reconstruction of all the busy buzz of activity that used to go on right behind our Main Street with the railroad. In addition to that, there's a model of the Dinky, which was the little railroad that ran back and forth between downtown Ames and the campus from 1891 to 1907. And that model is animated, so it like the Dinky used to, goes back and forth. But in addition to the models, we have a superb exhibit of posters in railroad art starting in 1869 through 1955. And it's a wonderful overview of how the railroad was enticing passengers to travel by train.
It's a very beautiful exhibit of those posters. The one I loved the most was one that says up in the sky.
Up in the air.
Up in the air.
Yes, the train will take you up in the air, and there's a picture of the Rocky Mountains.
Yeah.
I think it's the prettiest poster in the whole show, but you know, you'll have to go and look yourself and make your own decision.
So who put this exhibit together?
Well, we had three very ambitious curators doing the research, finding the pictures, and working with our graphic artist. It was me and Peggy Baer, who is retired from the Department of Transportation, where she was head of the rail division. So this was a natural assignment for her. And our third cohort was Bob Bourne, retired from MassaiRide. But he also is a true rail fan. And so the three of us made a great team in putting this together. It took us over a year. We installed the last 2 weeks in May and promptly took a week-long nap when that was finished. But it was a great project, and we hope that people will learn things that they really never knew before.
What made this happen?
What was the inspiration? Well, a very significant event. It's the sesquicentennial, the 150th anniversary of the founding of the Union Pacific Railroad. And, of course, Ames was established by the railroad. So Ames is a Union Pacific town, and it seemed like the right thing to commemorate that great event and to look in depth at how the trains made Ames.
How did the trains make Ames?
It was the mid-1860s. The Railroad Act, signed by Abraham Lincoln, had designated Omaha as the starting point for the construction of the Union Pacific Railroad west to the coast. So in order for the new Union Pacific Railroad to connect with the existing railroads to the east, rail lines had to be built across the state of Iowa. So Iowa was very critical in getting rail freight and rail traffic from Chicago to the new terminus in Omaha. So there were three railroad companies in competition to build across Iowa. And one of those three railroads was the Cedar Rapids and Missouri River Railroad. And they picked up a bankrupt railroad that had gotten to Cedar Rapids. So a new company formed, and they had a very dynamic man in charge, John Blair. And he raised the money, and he was in the field building. And he beat out the other two railroads getting to Omaha first. So Ames was on the route that John Blair established across Iowa. This was in the days of steam, so every 20 or 30 miles they needed a water stop. So he was building the railroad and establishing towns all across the state of Iowa to service the new railroad as it, after it was up and running. So Ames was one of those stops. Blair was aware of the state of Iowa's plan to build the college. He thought it would be an appropriate place to put one of those new towns. He was a part of the Ames family producing shovels for the gold rush. He, too, believed in the grand future for the railroad. That was a vision that he shared with Abraham Lincoln. And the railroad developers were hard-pressed to raise money. They were scrounging everywhere for friends who would loan them money for this huge enterprise. And Ames and his brother were two of the very visionary people who they really saw the promise of the railroad. So they loaned Blair money so that he could continue to build his railroad across the state of Iowa. So Blair was rewarding some of those good friends by naming towns after them. Now, Mr. Ames never did make it to Ames, but when the Congregational Church built the very first church in Ames, still on the location where it is today at 6th and Kellogg, he sent a beautiful cast bell for the belfry. And the Ames bell is still in the belfry at the Congregational Church, and a fine bell it is.
So Ames existed as a town before the railroad came. Presumably it had another name or it didn't have a name
well,
yet?
The town was platted in December 1864, and so it was established just prior to the time that the track came through. And the track came through in about January the next year, 1865. They built the first little depot in April 1865. So it was just a tiny bit before the track actually came through, but very close.
So it never had a different name.
No.
It was Ames.
No, it was always Ames from the very beginning. In all of the states west of the Mississippi, wherever the railroad went, the towns followed, settlement followed. So it was easy in the late 1860s to get from the East Coast to Iowa, to central Iowa, all along the route between Davenport and Omaha. It was very easy to get into central Iowa by way of the train. So the train spurred development all along the line. And with these railroads, it was so costly. And I mentioned how Blair picked up a railroad that had been bankrupt. That happened all over all the time. And so one would go bankrupt, and it would be picked up by a new company, and they would change the route. And towns would absolutely die if the railroad missed them by a mile or even 2 miles. So it was critical in those early days when there were no good roads and travel by wagon or horseback was extremely difficult. The railroad was absolutely pivotal.
The area that is now the parking lot behind Main Street.
Yes.
I remember that used to be a switchyard
right.
when I was growing up.
Well, in any place where you have rail traffic, you have to have an awful lot of track that's devoted simply to storage of cars. And in addition to that, there were many industries and businesses that were located right along the rail yard because it was an easy matter to lay a track directly to your loading dock, for example.
Mm-hmm.
The Ames Canning Company, for example, was at the east end of the rail yard, and they had their own siding where a freight train could back right into their loading dock, unload all of their canned goods, and then leave and join a bigger freight train to ship their goods.
And what were they canning?
They were canning mostly corn.
Of course.
Of course. A few tomatoes, some peas. They had a half a dozen things that they canned, and it was all locally grown and
wow.
shipped right from here. And for a long time, passenger trains and freight trains were in great competition, and it was very tricky to schedule freight and passengers on the same two-track main line because passenger trains were notoriously off schedule, and humans are a little more difficult to manage than crates of canned mm-hmm. corn. So it was really a challenge for the railroads to do all that scheduling. But all of that activity happened behind Main Street on the rail yards. And it was a very, very busy place, especially before a lot of those processes became automated. Ames was a crossroads in terms of rail. There were several active north-south lines as well. So Ames was very, very well connected by rail. So passengers could pick up the Fort Dodge line, go north or south down to Des Moines, or they could get on the main line, the east-west, and go into Chicago or to Omaha and beyond. Passenger traffic probably hit its peak during the World War II years, continued very active into the 50s, but by 1960, the very last passenger train left the depot in Ames, and passenger service was over that era.
To talk about the dinky just a little bit.
All right, sure. Well, in 1890, there were about three ways to get out to campus. Number one, you walked on the railroad main line, hoping that there weren't any trains coming through. And then when you got across Squaw Creek, you'd jump off on a little path that paralleled the track, and then you would walk to campus. Now, there was what they called the campus bus, which was actually a horse-drawn cart. It would pick you up down here at the corner of Main and Duff and take you out by road a couple of times a day. And then there was another walking route. But very unreliable. Half of the year, it was too muddy or wet to traverse very easily. And so by 1890, it was a very high priority to get better transportation between downtown Ames and the campus. And there were a group of about a dozen investors who put their money toward a small-scale railroad. They called it the Ames and College Railway. They had an agreement with the city of Ames to maintain a line and a regular schedule between downtown and campus, and they launched on the 4th of July, 1891, and provided regular service. They went from about 7 in the morning till about 10 o'clock at night, about every 20 minutes throughout the day, out and back. It was a little coal-powered steam train, and often spit a lot of cinders on the passengers as they were traveling along. They had three passenger cars that were often overstuffed, and people had to kind of hang on to the sides during the busiest parts of the day. And it had one flat car that was used to haul freight, and a number of the building projects in the 1890s, like the Campanile and Beecher Hall. Mm-hmm. So it was a very hard-working little train. And by 1907, the Fort Dodge line, which was going north-south through Ames, saw an opportunity to purchase the Ames and College Railway and hook it into their north-south line. They converted from the little steam train to an electric trolley. And so after 1907, the dinky was converted to an electric trolley, and it not only ran from downtown Ames to the campus, but you could continue down past Boone to the main north-south line, and you could be in Des Moines by the afternoon. And I think at its peak, they were running probably 14 back-and-forth trips between Ames and Des Moines. And it's hard to believe that in 1907, we had better public transportation to Des Moines than we have today. But it was very efficient and very popular.
And where did the word dinky come from?
Well, you know, we speculate.
Nobody knows.
Nobody really knows. Obviously, it might be a reference to the small size. It was a standard gauge, meaning that regular trains could run on the dinky's tracks, but it was just a very small-scale train. And the little locomotive was the sort of locomotive that you would find in the rail yards, just a little small-scale train just used for moving cars. not for hauling full-scale trains over long distances, just a little train for moving one or two cars here and there. And in a working rail community, that's called a donkey engine. So we wonder if it's just sort of a slurring of the word donkey.
Mm-hmm.
Dinky, donkey, little, you know, I don't know. Those are our speculations as to where the name came from. And I think it was the Iowa State students that conferred that name.
There was one more thing that jumped out at me at the exhibit that I wanted to talk about for
sure.
A minute. The line of sycamore trees.
Yes.
That goes between downtown and campus town.
Yes.
Now, I remember when I was young, there was 6th Street was a different street, which went right under those trees. I think it's the old road now that goes to the power plant. So every time you would drive, and so every time we would drive down 6th Street, we would drive under this line of trees that we call the money trees, because they would sparkle silver in the light, and they were so beautiful.
The sycamores, they were planted after the Dinky stopped running. So they were planted, I think, the Dinky stopped running in 1907 and then converted to the electric Fort Dodge line. And the Fort Dodge people kind of routed the trolley a little bit around the north side of campus. The Dinky used to go right down the middle of campus. It used to go in front of what is now Cat Hall, and then it would arrive at its little station, which is the hub, which is between Beardshire and the library now. But so when it was converted to the electric trolley, the tracks were switched to the north side of campus, so it kind of went around. So in addition to the trolley tracks, there was also a main line spur that mostly delivered coal to the power plant on campus. So there were tracks right along, it's kind of where the Cyride bus garage is today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then running parallel to that spur was a cinder path. It was a walking path. And for many, many years, it was just covered with cinders, you know, from the coal. In about 1910 or 1911, Iowa State's horticulturalist thought it would be really great to plant this row of sycamores. And so it started at the old landscape architecture building on campus, mm-hmm. which is still called that. It's on the east side of campus near the journalism building. So there were 50 sycamores that were planted running parallel to the cinder path and the former route of the Dinky, and then for a while, the spur from the Chicago and Northwestern. So it went all the way from the old landscape architecture building to Squaw Creek, 50 beautiful sycamore trees. And we have a great picture of those sycamores when they were just planted in just 4-foot-high sticks. And all of these years later now, mm-hmm. the 42 of the original 50 sycamores are still alive and thriving. And there are certain angles when you're walking where you can definitely see that beautiful row of sycamores. It's just a wonderful historic reference landscape here in Ames. And it was actually listed in a noteworthy landscape listing, a national listing.
It's one of the beautiful things about our town.
It is so special. And the shade that those big, big leaves creates on hot days like today, mm-hmm. it's really special. I was just astonished at every turn to learn new things about our town, to learn, first of all, about the early days, the race across Iowa, and how John Blair won the race and put Ames on the map and on the first transcontinental route. Like, it was, you just can't imagine how huge that was for our town. And then just the busy passenger service. There was one statistic I read that at one time in the late 30s, Ames sold more passenger tickets than any town in Iowa because of its location on both the north, south, and east, west rail lines.
It's like a crossroads.
Like a crossroads.
Did anything really surprise you?
Well, everything surprised me because I was so new to the subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
But Ames, for example, had a woman station master in the 1920s, probably the only one in the whole country. She was very pivotal. The development, the simultaneous development of the telegraph, because the railroad companies knew they had to be able to communicate easily from station to station. And so simultaneously with the laying of the track was the installation of telegraph poles,
mm-hmm.
so that there was this communication system that had to be in existence absolutely at the same time. And that was something I really didn't even think about. about, but it was new to me and very interesting to learn.
Did it change the way you look at the town now?
It really does. It really does. All those trains that roar through, you really look at them in a completely different way, and you see how incredibly important they were and continue to be.
In today's town, how do you see the railroad? I mean, obviously, we're always crossing railroad tracks in this town.
That's right.
And we're seeing trains go through all the time, very often, really.
Yeah.
How do you think, beyond that, beyond the sounds that you hear, how do you think that it affected how we live today?
Well, you know, it's a little harder today because in the earlier days, railroad, the people who worked on the railroad lived right here in town. And that's not so true anymore. And, of course, we were talking about the railroads behind Main Street with all the spurs that went right to the front door of our or the back door of our local businesses. And that doesn't happen so much. Although, one of the reasons that Barilla Pasta established their factory in Ames was because they could get their own rail spur. And some of the other big industries like Ball Plastics, those folks are in our town because of the easy rail access. So it still has an impact on the industry and of our industry of our town. But certainly the railroad is extremely pivotal to Iowa. You know, in the fall, we see the harvest of our fields going to market. We see coal coming to central Iowa from Wyoming, which is still a very essential source of energy. And so we may not live next door to someone who works on the railroad, but our daily lives are absolutely impacted by what the railroad delivers.
You know, what's funny, I lived in Brooklyn for the last 30 years in New York City. And at night, I would hear these loud horns. And I would always think to myself, the train's going through. That's the train. And I think I was living there for maybe 15, 20 years before one night, I finally, it dawned on me that those were boats. It's what do they say? You can take the girl out of Iowa,
That's
but you
right.
can't take
you
Iowa
can't
out
take
of the girl.
Iowa out of the girl, you just assumed.
Because horns, the sound of those trains is what you grow up with in this town.
Absolutely.
It's part of our environment.
It is. Yeah. Well, I was tickled. My little nephew was visiting from the San Francisco area just a couple of weeks ago, and they were down on Main Street. He and his family were down on Main Street, and one of the Union Pacific roared through, the locomotives roared through with the beautiful big flag on the side of it, and he stopped in his tracks, and he says, "Hey, that's the train that goes through my town." And we said, "You are absolutely right," and that's how far it goes.
That's the connection.
Ames all the way to San Francisco. He figured that out. So,
if somebody listening to this would like to find out more, or where can they find the information?
The Ames Historical Society website, www.ameshistoricalsociety.org.
That's ameshistoricalsociety.org.
And while you're online, you can explore hundreds of local stories online. We consider our website our virtual museum, and you can do a lot of research and just a lot of recreational browsing right on our website. And if you have not taken a look, we hope that you will.
Tell us just a little bit about the Historical Society.
Well, we have been in existence since 1980, founded by Farwell Brown, and some of our residents will remember him as our Ames historian. He has written many books on different subjects and has since passed away. So we are a relatively young historical organization, just 31 or 2 years here in the business. But we are hard at work developing a history center for the community of Ames, and we are very dependent on memberships to float our day-to-day operations. We are located at 416 Douglas, right across the street from the Octagon. We have regular open hours Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday afternoon. And we do have a historical collection and a wonderful archives that people can come down and use to do research.
So, again, if somebody wants to find out about the Historical Society, it's
ameshistoricalsociety.org. We're also in the phone book, easy to find, Ames Historical Society, 232-2148.
232-2148. And how do you feel about Ames?
How do I feel about Ames? What a great place to live. And once you know the stories, it explains a lot of things. A lot of the way, of course, we are the way we are because of where we've been. Mm-hmm. And once you understand those stories, you can stop scratching your head so much about how the trains made Ames.
This is really about the heart and soul of our town's origins.
It is.
So it gives you a great feeling of connection to really what this town is. And there's really something for everybody. There's paintings, there's posters, there's models, there's a lot of kind of detailed paper documents for people who like the details.
And some artifacts.
So it's a great exhibit. It's just a lot of fun. And thank you so much for coming and telling us about it.
And don't forget, it'll be there through October 28th.
And the gallery is where?
Third floor. Octagon, 427 Douglas, Ames, Iowa.
That's 427 Douglas.
Douglas, yes.
Absolutely.
And thank you for having me on the radio.
I'm heading back from Fremont on this old freight train. Across the Iowa border, rolling over these great plains. 20 years in conductor, an old locomotive riding home again. Steaming toward tomorrow, with dreams from yesterday. Steaming toward tomorrow. You better get on board, all aboard, for this train pulls away. Miss Kate Shelley High Bridge, we'll be crossing you real soon. Over the Des Moines River, then 3 more miles into Boone. Spend the night with my wife. Come morning, I'll be called out by noon. Steaming toward tomorrow, with dreams from yesterday. Steaming toward tomorrow. Better get on board, haul aboard, for this train pulls away. Next month is my vacation, September and old puffer belly days. Gonna join that celebration with people from nearly every state. Take a ride on 1385 and feel them old-fashioned railroad ways. Steaming toward tomorrow, with dreams from yesterday. Steaming toward tomorrow, you'd better get on board, haul aboard, for this train pulls away. Better get on board, haul aboard, for this train pulls away.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we're here talking about the people, the events, and the stories of Central Iowa. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, and I'm here with
Benjamin Beloit.
And Benjamin, you spoke with the city manager this week to discuss the city budget.
Yes, so we thought our city manager, Steve Schenker, would be a great person to start off talking to, and he's been in his office for about 30 years, actually. So we went to City Hall, and boy, we had an interesting conversation about how decisions are made, assessments are made. Specifically, there are a couple of little new investments, capital investments, those investments that are new improvements. And we also talked about a couple of new public positions. So we went to City Hall and spoke with Steve Schenker, and this is what he had to say.
This is Benjamin Beloit for KHOI, and I'm here in City Hall with Steve Schenker, the city manager. How are you, Steve?
Great.
Thanks for taking some time with us today. It is evident, both from looking at the city budget and from looking around at the country right now, that Ames is in a relatively good position fiscally.
Very good. Yes.
You make a note of that in your report.
Yep.
To what chief factors would you credit that?
Well, first of all, I've worked for over 33 years with some excellent city council members who, throughout my tenure, have always placed the good of the city council, of the citizens in the city first before their own private concerns. So they've also taken a long-term view. Sometimes if you take a short-term view, they want to get reelected, they won't make those good, solid financial decisions. They might leverage the future to be popular with a decision. And we've been very fortunate. With that long-term view and commitment to the citizens, I think they've made some wise fiscal decisions over the years. Also, obviously, we're very blessed to have Iowa State University here. That's very important economic generator for the community. It poses some concerns and challenges sometimes and stress on our community. But overall, the positives outweigh the negatives tenfold. And we've been benefit of that. But, you know, college towns are not recession-proof, but they're certainly in better position than a lot of cities are. So having the college and the university here is very important. It also allows for some spin-offs and businesses to grow out of the university from some great ideas that come out of it. So that helps our economic development, and that's the engine that drives the community. And I think we're blessed to have a number of dedicated city employees that work with me, and they've taken a long-term commitment to the community, a long-term vision too. So they're not going to mortgage the future for some short-term gains.
Let's get into the brass tacks of the city budget. We are right now in the process of putting together next year's budget, and we operate on the fiscal year, of course, which starts on July 1.
That's correct. July 1 to June 30th.
So tell us where we are in that process right now.
Well, just last week we completed, actually the kickoff to this is the town budget meeting, where I try to go out and hold a public meeting just to get some ideas from the community. What are the issues that are out there? What are some of their concerns or desires for big projects in our capital improvement plan, or some service levels they like to see increase or decrease? Because I don't like to go into preparing a budget blind, so I try to get a sense of what the public wants. We do that at the town budget meeting. We also have a citizen satisfaction survey, a statistically valid survey that's sent out to the community, and we try to get input that way too. So we kicked that off a couple of weeks ago, and now the city staff's going to go back, and it's our responsibility to prepare a budget for the city council to consider. And we'll come back in the end of January with our recommendations, both on a five-year capital improvement plan and a one-year operating budget for the community. So that's what we're doing now. We're working internally to piece together our service plan for next year. See, a budget is more than just a bunch of numbers. It is a financial plan. But more importantly, it's what you do with the money. It tells you what the services you're going to provide, the level of service you're going to provide, the type of projects you're going to engage in. So that's what we're putting in essence, a service plan for the community for the next year. So we're going to be working the next couple of months to put that together, and we'll unveil that in January to the public and the council.
And Steve, tell me a little bit about the format of the budget that we use.
Yeah, it's interesting. You can live in different cities and find that the format that's used by the city is different. In the city of Ames, we have what's known as a program performance budget. Normally, I'd probably say 90% of the cities throughout the country have what's known as a line item budget. And what that is, if you open up their budget, you can go to each department, like the fire department, and you can look at the budget, and you know they'd have a line item called travel expense or personal services, postage. You can look at all that. And you'd see it for all the departments, but it really doesn't tell you anything about services. What are you receiving in services, and what are you paying for it? If you go to the City of Ames budget, and by the way, our budget and capital improvement plan are on the website. Everybody has access to it if you want to. Ours is what's known as a program performance budget. We aggregate expenditures by service levels, not by departments. And it's interesting. Some service levels transcend departments. To give you an example, if you want to know what we're paying for parking, the parking service, if you think about it, parking takes expenditures or efforts from the Public Works Department who maintain the meters. Mm-hmm. You've got the city attorney's office who maybe has to, unfortunately, sometimes prosecute violators. You have the police department who issues the tickets, right? And the finance department who has to send out the tickets and keep track of the payments. That's four separate departments. Under traditional line item budget by department, those expenditures would be a little bit in each one of those departments. But you would never know what is the total cost of this parking effort. We aggregate all that, so if you look in our budget, we don't care what department is. We just talk about that parking services. It will have all those expenditures by the departments in one place, aggregated. And you'll know now what's the cost of the parking service. So that's really good because it tells the citizen what they're getting for their money in services, not that I'm paying for a certain department. We also have performance indicators there, and that's important. If you look at the Public Works Department, you'll see, we put it in there, what the cost to, let's say, plow a curb mile or a mile of street, okay, what it costs. That type of effectiveness or efficiency measure is listed there. It allows you to benchmark with other cities. In other words, well, if we're doing it for $5 a mile, what's West Des Moines doing? What's Des Moines doing? What if you find out they're doing it for $2? Mm-hmm. You'd say, city, why can't we get better? Now, what if they're all doing it for $20? You'd say, boy, we're doing pretty good. So you can benchmark it against other cities. Mm-hmm. You can also benchmark it with yourself, saying, well, this year it takes me $100 per mile to plow the snow. I want to do better. So let's work with our employees, and then I could gauge it next year. What if it goes down to $90? We've improved. So you can benchmark against yourself to try to do better each year. So it's pretty good when you have performance measures with it. So we have a combination of program and performance measures, and that's unusual. As I said, if you look throughout the country, you'll probably see most are line item by department. So I think we have a superior budget format. And again, I encourage everybody to get online to cityofames.org, and you can go to the finance department, and you can see the capital improvement plan, which is a five-year plan for some of our major brick-and-mortar projects for the next 5 years, our strategic plan. And you look at the individual fiscal year budget, as you talked about, is there too. This performance program performance budget's there. It's all accessible from the public.
So suppose there's a citizen out there listening to this who hasn't heard from a city council member or spoken to a city council member, but they want to have some input on the budget. What should they do?
That's great. The beauty of this process, we're only at the beginning of it, so they can email the city council. Their emails are on the website for the City of Ames, cityofames.org. They can email me or the finance director with their ideas. And we will have actually public hearings in February where they can show up and meet face-to-face with the council before the council makes the final decision. I think it's the first week of February. You'll see those advertised, too. They could come before the council and express their ideas. Now, we can't guarantee that every idea will be put in the budget because we have a lot of great ideas and diversified community. But you'll see there are many instances where when the council saw that there was a real groundswell for a certain project or a certain service, I think they try to react given the financial limitations they have before them. So there's plenty of time to provide input into the budget.
But you don't want to procrastinate too long.
Well, we can't. In fact, by state law, we have to have our budget certified, meaning to the state, for approval by March 15th. There's a deadline. So it can take place, because, like you said, so it could be initiated on July 1st.
Right.
So the state has a deadline. We have to get the whole process done.
Let's talk about some of the specifics of the budget for this year. It's only a slight percentage increase in the overall budget from last year, 2%.
Yeah, actually our rate went down, our tax rate went down.
There were just a few new investments that we are making. One of them is about $250,000 to assess the most efficient way to mitigate flood damage in the future. Mm-hmm. Tell us, how is that assessment being undertaken?
Well, this is the outgrowth of, we've had a lot of floods dating back many years, and the most recent in 2010. And this is going to be a major initiative and a complicated task, I think, to accomplish. We're never going to eliminate floods because it's going to rain too much sometime and we're going to have flooding. We're trying to mitigate the property damage. The way to do this, you've got to bring in some consultants, outside experts, and that's what we've done. We've hired a consulting firm that's going to set up a series, and they're going on now, public input sessions. So they're going to get some information from the public on where the flooding occurred and what the observations for the people of the people who were involved in it. Then they've got to apply some engineering techniques to analyze what's happening. And in the future, you know, they're going to give us recommendations on possible flood mitigation techniques. What they'd be, I don't know. Sometimes they may be solutions that are upstream, even outside the city limits. We may have to do something to hold the water, yeah. You know, hold it there so it slows down the rate of runoff to the city. I don't know what kind of capital improvements will be needed. And then we'll have to do a cost benefit, and they could come up with something and says, you know, it'll cost $300 million, and we're going to have to raise your taxes 300%. Now, do the citizens want to do that for something that may flood once a year, you know, once every 10 years? There'll be some really difficult decisions to make in the future. And again, no matter what you do, it'll probably rain, and whatever public improvement put in place, it's not foolproof. It can rain more than the calculated amount, and you'll still get flooding. So there's going to be a balance, as there always is when you spend public funds. But it's the private consulting firm that's going to do this analysis and come forward and lay out a series of possible steps, and the council will have to weigh the cost-benefit of each one of them before we implement them.
Of course, the country is very politically charged right now. How do you see that playing out?
I don't think we engage in partisan politics. We do have differences of opinion. Yeah. People see the world differently. They think that solutions are differently, and you can argue about all those things. Some people believe in global warming. Some people think not global warming. So that's related to more rainfall, less rainfall, right?
Yeah.
So we don't bring in, I don't think, partisan politics in here. But Ames is a highly educated community, and people who participate in government, that's all great. But that brings with it a variety of positions, perspectives, ideas, and suggested solutions. And therefore, it makes it harder for the city council to do something that satisfies the majority of the people, because so many people have different opinions. So it's very difficult to be on the city council in the city of Ames.
Right.
The positive thing is people participate. They're very knowledgeable. The negative thing is there's a lot of different ideas. So if you say, I'm here to represent the community and satisfy your needs, I can tell you I can sit down and I get phone calls about a lot of my recommendations, and people are arguing both sides or three sides. So it's hard to satisfy everyone in this community.
Yeah. Another couple smaller investments that we're making are for a civil engineer and a business developer.
Right.
How are the needs for those positions arrived at?
Well, each year we look at the number of capital improvements. This is in the Public Works Department, specifically related to streets. And we analyze it all the time. What's the most cost-effective way to handle something? Because it affects, you know, the citizens' money. We want to do it the cheapest way possible and still maintain quality. Well, we were looking over the years, if we had 10 or 12 capital improvements, let's say street improvements, we have to send those out and be designed by an engineer. And we were finding works in opposite. Usually you say contract out, it saves you money. We were actually finding sending things out for contract design was adding up more than if we hired our own position.
Hmm.
That's interesting, because in the past we always thought, oh, let's send it out.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes when you contract out, it works if it's just periodic. But if you have a whole year's worth of work that you could justify, we actually proved that we could hire a person cheaper to do the design of these capital improvements than to send them out to an outside consultant who would charge us 15% of the project cost.
Mm-hmm.
So actually it was a cost-benefit type of thing. We save money by hiring the person in that analysis. That's one reason we did it. So that's the reason for that one. The other one was the business development coordinator. One of the top goals of the city council is economic development, the city council. And they wanted to create a can-do attitude for businesses who want to expand in town or come to town. And what they wanted to do is create a position where we would have someone available when a business wants to do something new to expand. And working with the city sometimes is complex if you don't know the procedures, all the laws. So this is a person who's actually going to take them by the hand and be their advocate, their ombudsman, to walk them through the system, the complex system of getting permits, approvals through. It could be zoning, it could be building codes or whatever. So it's an additional service for these businesses. And they seem to appreciate that, because sometimes they come to town, they don't, you know, every city's different how they handle things. The different procedures for zoning, for site planning. And to have this asset there for them is very powerful. They really appreciate it.
Hmm. Going back to the floods for a moment, are there any specific results yet, or is it too early in the assessment?
Too early in the assessment. That's where we hope that the consultant will come up with some options and the costs related to them.
Okay.
But I do think the solution is not going to be just for the city of Ames. Again, it will probably be multi-jurisdictional because what we've learned is, you know, when we have flooding, it's not when we have 10 inches of rain right in Ames.
Yes.
It's when it rains up north and that watershed that brings it down. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have to deal with the county maybe or some of the cities. Our watershed actually goes up to Stanhope. It's when it rains in Stanhope for 4 inches we really pay attention to. Usually when it rains right here in Ames, that's the water that goes downstream, and they have to worry about it in you know, downstream in some of those cities.
Huh. Other than what we've mentioned already, are there any other investments, new investments, that you believe will be wanting for the city of Ames in the future?
When you look at our budget, our budget's made up of a number of businesses, separate businesses. It's tough to draw any conclusions if you look at the bottom number and you say it went up or down. And I'll show you why, because we maintain the electric utility, the water utility, the sanitary sewer utility, the resource recovery utility. And all those utilities, we have to make major capital investments in the future. We're looking at our sanitary sewer to see it's, you know, any kind of improvements we have to make there, because we have an old system that maybe has a lot of leaks in it that we have to fix, because you don't want that sanitary sewer leaking. You want to make sure that sanitary sewer water goes down to our plant and is treated and goes out into the stream very clean. So there's major investments we have to make in that system. The electric utility, we're looking in the future strategic plan, how we meet the power needs of our customers into the next 50 years. Water treatment, you maybe don't know about this, we're building a new $62 million water treatment plant, same way our 100-year-old plant is outdated, can't be retooled. Mm-hmm. So you're going to see major investments in our utilities. Those utilities are important not only to meet the needs of our current customers, but also if we hope to expand and bring in new businesses or expand our existing businesses, we're going to have to make those investments. Those are very costly, and that's why you see some of our rates are starting to go up.
Well, I thank you very much for taking the time with me today.
Well, good. I hope you come back. I know as the next couple of months, maybe in February or so, when the budget's unveiled, you might have some more questions, and we could try to educate your listeners on the budget more.
Why do you manage a city?
Well, from a young age, I knew that you could do a lot of things. You could pick a lot of career choices, but I wanted to make a difference in people's lives, not just collect a paycheck. And where else do you impact people's lives every day than in local government? You know, if you look at all the services we provide, I impact a lot of people, and that's pretty powerful stuff. It's pretty meaningful work, and that's why I got into this business and will continue to do it. Because deep down, we're a service industry. That's what city government does, and that's in my heart and soul is what I want to do. I want to help people, and I want to serve people, and that's what we can do in local government, and that's why I'm here.
That was KHOY reporter Ben Beloit speaking with the city manager, Steve Shanker, regarding the formation of the city budget for Ames.
I did also want to run a few basic facts by our audience from the budget. The population of Ames is about 60,000 right now, with about 25,000 students, and the median income is about $36,000. The city of Ames had an annual revenue last year of $180 million, which includes about $80 million worth of utilities, which is about the same proportion that we spend on utilities. And the capital improvement budget was about 28% of the total budget, which included $32 million for utilities and $14 million for transportation.
Thank you. So you're going to be back in the next few weeks to come to tell us more about the budget and how that process is developing.
Yep, I'm looking forward to it. And I did want to tell our listeners that if they have any input about the city budget process, if they have any experience with it, go ahead and send us an email at khoiradio@gmail.com. khoiradio@gmail.com. And we'll incorporate that into our programming.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Local Talk,
where we hear about the stories, the events, and the people of Central Iowa.
We were looking at Ames today, our past as a city built by the railroad, and we spoke with Kathy Sveck of the Ames Historical Society about their exhibit, Rail Reality, How the Trains Made Ames. The exhibit will be at the Octagon Arts Center until October 28th. The Octagon Arts Center is at 427 Douglas in Ames. That's 427 Douglas in Ames. For information about the Ames Historical Society, go to ameshistoricalsociety.org. That's ameshistoricalsociety.org. For information about the Octagon,
go to octagonarts.org. octagonarts.org. Then we looked at our present and future when KHOI reporter Ben Beloit spoke with Ames City Manager Steve Shanker about the process the city is just beginning for creating our next year's city budget. If you would like to take a look at the city budget process and past budgets, or give feedback to the city, go to cityofames.org. That's cityofames.org, and look at the finance section. Ben also welcomes your comments for use in future broadcasts, and you can write to him at khoiradio@gmail.com. That's khoiradio@gmail.com. The music pieces we heard today were Lonesome Train and Steaming Towards Tomorrow by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kay Shelley. And they also provided the theme music for Local Talk, Backtrackin', also from The Ballad of Kay Shelley. I have been your host today, Ursula Rudenberg, with Ben Beloit. We thank you for listening and see you again on the radio.
Elwin Taylor. This is a River City memory. I remember the 50s. It was a good time to be a teenager. Our city of 490 people was on the bench above a small river. Just a creek by Midwest standards, but we loved our river, and we loved River City. Recorded for KHOI-FM, community radio, for Central Iowa. Trading cars and horses. Grandpa has a new Pontiac, again. I think his cars are about the fanciest cars in town. It has a metal visor to keep the sun out of the window. I called it an awning. Dad said it's not an awning. And a little glass thing on the dashboard, so you can still see the stoplights. Grandpa calls stoplights semaphores. Grandpa gets a lot of new cars. A lot of new horses, too. Dad says, Grandpa is just a horse trader at heart. Last spring, I wanted to ride the new saddle horse. Gerald said, watch out, it bites. But just hit it on the nose when it tries. It was a pretty horse, but the pretty ones always seem to have some bad habit like that. Now Grandpa has a new sorrel. When we first got her, Gerald said, watch out, she lays down. So be sure to put your feet up on top if she starts. After about 10 minutes, she lay right down. But I got my legs up on top in time so they didn't get smashed. I couldn't ever make her get up. One day I wandered up by the tree to watch the anthill, and the sorrel came over to see what I was doing. So I led her over by the fence, climbed up the fence, and jumped right on. That always seemed to work, every time she lay down. She always has to know what I am doing if I walk away. Last week, Paul and I rode down to Uncle Ray's to see if there was still some asparagus by the ditch. Paul said, "We need to give the horses a drink." I said, "No, she'll lie down in the water." Paul just laughed and rode his horse out in the water so she could drink. The sorrel went with her too and lay right down in the water. Paul said, "You should sit on her head." So I sat on her head. She really kicked. In a little while, she quit kicking. Then I was really scared, but she got up, and she hasn't tried to lay down since.